There's, it costs a lot to go, spend your downtime in Ibiza or something. Oosh.
I was never a fan of Ibiza.
Nah, I have no interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to go anywhere where Justin Bieber's been.
Your world is dwindling. Oh, that's why you're in Rancho Cucamonga.
That's right. He'll never come here. All right. It's Tuesday. It's what's the date today?
It is August 5th.
August 5th, 2014. This is episode 119 of the On Taking Pictures show.
You could have gone either way there. You could have gone Letterman with program.
Yeah, the On Taking Pictures program.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah. Welcome. But you decided to go Ed Sullivan?
I don't know.
It's a
I don't know.
Show.
Welcome to the show. big show. Big show. But before that, thanks for taking the time to join us. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadedandblurred.com, where, hey, you'll find some really spiffy vintage-looking camera t-shirts. I got to send you one.
Yeah, you do.
You gotta tell me which one you want.
I think
pick,
I'll
pick a design,
Hasselblad,
pick a color,
or Leica.
See, you gotta pick one.
Hasselblad.
All right, pick a color. Tell me size and all that, and I'll send you one.
Okay.
And with me the shirtless.
Bill I'm wearing Watt. A shirt. What are you talking about? People are always saying, trying to take the shirt off my back. So I guess
what?
You could say, yeah. I did pull a muscle, though, man. It hurts like hell.
That's what you said. You had a bad reach around.
I hate getting old.
What was that?
I swear to God, I reached up to turn off my speaker, and I pulled a muscle on my left shoulder just now.
Oh,
it's not fun, but what are you going to do?
You're just a delicate flower, Bill Wadman.
I'm something. Hey, speaking of flowers, yesterday I spent some time with a photographer who we're going to talk about next week as Photographer of the Week. But this guy, Michel Terevkov, who is this old school sort of a lot of special effect photography, used to
practical,
do all this
though, right?
practical special effect photography back in the day, before Photoshop. He was building all these sets in miniature and shooting something and then cutting it out and then getting an invert of it printed on Duratran so we could backlight it. And that was the background for, like all this kind of really, oh yeah, it was totally cool. Like the kind of stuff that you and I would totally geek out on if we had to do the same thing and we didn't have Photoshop,
Yeah. You said he did covers for Omni.
Yeah. He like all that kind of stuff
magazine.
From the '80s. Yeah.
That was a really fun magazine.
Yeah. So he's been there, been everywhere, done that. And he's retiring. The reason I bring this up is he's retiring. And, my friend of mine used to work for him. So we went over to his studio cause he's having a big studio sale, selling all the stuff. So we went over to take a look before the actual studio sale to see if there's anything that, we could get for a song. So I may buy some C-stands and stuff that he had, and he had, all that kind of junk.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool, those old, big drawers to put paper in and that kind of stuff? Those old metal drawers you probably can't even buy quite the same heft anymore?
Flat files.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So he's got all that kind of stuff, and some old Speedotron strobes and that kind of stuff, which he's selling, the packs and heads for $200.
Huh.
So
now why this is something, this is interesting to me. Retiring from photography. I mean, it's not like you're retiring from...
He's retiring from commercial photography and advertising.
Okay.
So he's going to keep doing his own stuff, but his own stuff he can do from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So he's what do you say? He's got a place in Sarasota. They have a place in Jersey City. They have an apartment in Paris. They're just going to bop around. And he was very successful and had this really nice loft studio in Chelsea that is what I visited yesterday. But we spent a lot of time just sitting there chatting, and I ended up, he gave me a copy of his first book cause he found a bunch of copies in a closet, and he's just like, "Oh, you want a copy?" I was like, "Oh yeah." And he signed it for me. And we were looking through and he was telling me how he did all these different pictures and, "Oh, then I did this and I inverted that and I moved that and those are ping pong balls and that kind of thing."
Sure.
And I'll talk about that more next year. But he was standing there towards the end and he said, two things. He's like, "I have two pieces of advice for you."
Excuse me.
And this is where it gets interesting. He said, I have two pieces of advice for you. Number one, put away money. And all I could think in my head was, the minute I start making some, sir, I will put some away.
Yeah.
And the second one was, he said, make a 10-year goal, stick to it, and then any major decisions you make, ask yourself whether they get you closer to that goal or further away. Right? This whole goal sort of thing.
Goals are good. Goals are necessary.
But here's my thing. How do you define goals in an artistic pursuit? I mean, I could make business goals for myself. I could say, I want to be billing out $500,000 a year and have a studio and do this and do that. But how do I know what it is? How do I define what it is that I'm trying to achieve in any sort of artistic way in words? Or how do I perceive that? If I haven't had the inspiration yet, how am I supposed to know what the goal is supposed to be?
Okay. Well, that's the
question.
No, one of the things is I don't know that you can have a 10-year creative goal.
Right.
Other than maybe, you know, I would like to have had X number of solo shows, or I would like to, you know, those kinds of things. But even those aren't really creative goals. Those are still sort of strategic and logistical goals.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
But I think there does have to be some sort of step-by-step or some sort of plan that you can follow that lets you know how you're doing, okay? Because a goal without strategy is just an empty promise to yourself.
Yes, but in the same way, a strategy without goal is equally useless.
I think you can have goals as a creative. First of all, you are one of those types of people, and we've talked about this several times, where the word goal or the word strategy is much like the word business to you, and it's a dirty word. It feels like an assignment. It feels like you've said this many, many times.
Yeah, it feels contrived.
Well, but there has to be a yardstick by which you measure progress. There has to be some, you know, if you're putting up the same kind of picture with the same kind of lighting, with the same kind of whatever, what are you doing? You're not doing anything. You're doing the same thing over and over and over again. So you're not moving towards anything. Yeah, okay, you're putting up work. But one of the other things that artists have a difficult time reconciling is, newsflash, not everything you do is precious. Not everything you do is a special flower and needs to be shared with the world.
Right.
Some things are iterative experiments that get you from one position or one place or one mode of thinking to another.
Yes. But it still doesn't, but there's still the question of, I wouldn't know what goals to set even if I had an idea of what they were. But I think part of that is that in my whole life, I've never had a vision of myself 10 years or 20 years or 30 years down the line as, oh, I'll be this when I grow up, or life will look like this when I grow up.
To play devil's advocate, or to play the part of your friend here, maybe that's why you're sort of plateaued at where you are currently, because you can't see beyond where you are. You can't see what's next on the horizon. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know.
Yeah, well, see, it's just a weird thing, because I think that, but I know a lot of people who are very goal-orientated people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them achieve their goals, but achieving their goals doesn't make them happy, because by the time they achieve their goals, they aren't really their goals anymore. And, you know, there's those kinds of things, too.
That's them, and you're comparing yourself to them, and you're not them, you're you.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm saying, I'm not talking about me right now this exact second. I'm talking about like the general idea of goals. But I think that's part of where I not fear goals, but I just I wonder whether I question their utility in reality.
Okay.
You know, it's the whole, you know, life's what happens when you're making other plans thing.
Sure.
You know.
Let's go back for you to 2007.
Yep.
You had a goal of doing drabbles, doing one drabble a day for a year. That was a goal.
The 365 portraits. Yes, I did.
Yeah. Okay. That. Right. Sorry. That was a goal. Okay. Then would you say that was the last large scale project like that that you've done?
Well, I would define large scale project. I mean, okay. I did 46 drabbles in 60 days.
Right, right.
You know, but, and I, yeah, I mean, and I did, you know, daily projects in 2011, and I've done, you know, X amount of these things this year, which I haven't shared okay. yet, you know.
You, yeah. What I'm saying is, yeah, you've done sprints. The, yeah. The 365
yep.
project was a marathon.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. That was a long-term goal.
A one-year goal. That was long-term?
I think for a lot of people, a year is hugely long-term.
Yeah, but see, I can see a year. I can't see 10 years.
Then don't. Maybe 10 years doesn't work for you. Maybe maybe a year out works for you. Maybe 18 months out works for you. Maybe 3 years out works for you.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, can you see 10 years out?
No, but that's not the way I think.
Well, how do you think about goals?
I think about goals. I think about daily goals, and I think about monthly goals. I think about achievable goals.
And what if you don't achieve the goal you set for that month?
Then I do a post-mortem on myself and try and figure out why.
Okay. And does this...
It affects me in different ways. You know, some of the current goals that I have, and I've got my, if I'm looking to my left here, I've got two closet doors, floor to ceiling, that are whiteboards.
Right.
And they're filled with stuff, some right. of which I will get to, some of which I won't. But at any point during the day, if I'm overwhelmed or if I'm lost or I feel like I don't know what I can do, I can look to my left and go, okay, that still needs to be done. That still needs to be done.
Right. But you find that that is a useful tool for you.
I find that it's almost necessary because I have so many things that I'm inspired by, moved by, and interested in. If I don't have it concretely written down, it will get lost in the shuffle, you know?
Right.
So I have for you know, some of the things for this week, order polypropylene for the new pieces that I'm doing. So I've got, like, today after we do the show, I've got to call this place in the Midwest and order
building a plastic suit, huh?
Yeah, I've got to order another 4x8 sheet. That's right, a 4x8 sheet of 030 polypropylene that I use as carrier sheets to do the gelatin transfers or the emulsion transfers that I need for the new work.
I got you. I'll tell you, it's pretty cool. The internet's pretty cool that you can just buy that stuff like that.
It's very cool because you used to have to, if you could find it, you had to drive to LA to get it. So
yeah.
There's that. I've got order new art supplies with a check mark next to it.
Yep.
So I've done that. I've got, you know, order paint from Nova Color. There's a check mark next to that. I've done that. You know, I find that lists and short-term goals work for me because long-term goals are something that I don't see very well.
Yeah, that's my thing. Like, I use lists all the time. By the way,
I still have them.
I find it much more satisfying to write lists down than to type them. You?
Oh, of course.
Like, I mean, I have a scrap of paper here that has, I have an 8x10 piece of paper or whatever, 8.5x11, with the lists from like 10 days, just like, oh, I need to find a little space. So I like block out a little spot over in the corner and I write the list for it. You know,
right.
Somehow that is much more satisfying than making a list on my phone.
Yeah.
I've tried it 10 times with 10 different apps and it never works.
Part of it for me is the muscle memory of writing.
Okay, yeah,
part
for
of
you,
it is,
yeah, you've got that thing.
Is I remember things because I'm watching myself write it down.
Yeah.
So there's that sort of reinforcement. There's a visual reinforcement of me doing it. There's an actual motion of me doing it. You know, and I'm by and large, I'm pretty analog. I mean, if computers went away, it would be harder to get the stuff that I use, but I could still function.
Sure.
I wouldn't like it, but you know, there are certain things that I still really enjoy and prefer
yeah.
to do analog. But in terms of a 10-year goal, what do I do? You know, I don't know. You know, 10 years ago, I had a 10-year goal of wanting to be able to do whatever I wanted to do any given day.
Right.
And I pretty much do. Right. I get to do pretty much what I want to do. So now what's next? Now you have to think, all right, what's beyond that? You know,
yeah.
Well, now I want to be, you know, happier more consistently. I want to challenge myself. I want to find new work to celebrate. I want to find new artists to talk to.
But are those things too? And I have lists like that myself, but I feel like those things are not concrete enough because it's nearly impossible to actually test them. You know, they're not things you can check off. You know, in 10 years, I'll be living in Hawaii in a house on a cliff on whatever your your crazy dreams are.
Well, I think that, first of all, are they professional goals or personal goals?
Well, are those two things different? Are they separate?
Yeah.
You know, or could it be that the whole idea of long-term goals works for some people and just doesn't work for other people?
I think that's part of it.
Maybe this guy was doing well in 1985 or whatever it is and made some goal for 1995, but his business was building and the whole goal in reaching the goal had less to do with him setting the goal and striving towards that than the fact that he was just on a roll work-wise.
Yeah, and that's entirely possible. Now, for some people like David Duchemin, you know, when I asked him what of any of this, if you asked yourself 10 years ago, is this where, you know, could you see any of this? How much of this could you see 10 years ago? And he said none of it.
Yeah.
None of it. You know, in general terms, here's where I want to be. But the way to get there, who knows? You know, my friend Kingsley, down in Perth, Western Australia, sent me a book last week called Body of Work, Finding the Thread That Ties Your Story Together by Pamela Slim. And this is an incredible book for me. It hits me exactly where I live in terms of helping me to define what drives me, what my strengths are, what my areas that I need work on are, what my ingredients are, what my circle is or should be.
What does that mean?
Your circle of influence, your tribe, your ingredients, the people you have around you.
Okay.
Whether it's a professional support system or a personal support system, because I think those are equally important. It's a fantastic book, and I think I'm noodling on doing an actual book club for Process Driven, and this will be the first book. There are exercises at the end of each chapter that I think would be great to work through. But what I'm seeing by doing this, and I've only had this book a week, but part of it, you know, is I've been doing work on this for months. But it's giving me things to look at, to check off, and to think about in the future that I can then check off.
Yeah.
So there's a progression that I'm setting up that I can measure.
Okay. Here's my question though. And you just used a lot of I don't know. I just every time that I've ever tried to use we'll use them tools for lack of a better word, right? All the things that you've just said. It never worked for me. And I know maybe it doesn't work for me. Maybe it works for other people, but has that kind of strategy worked for you in the past?
Yes.
Cause you must've tried it in the past.
Yes.
So what stopped you from, if it was working, what moved you away from it?
My lack of adherence to what worked. My getting, you know, complacent, maybe.
Okay. So it's like getting back on the horse or.
Yeah. Well, it's like AA for creatives. You've got to kind of work the program.
Yes.
And if you're not working the program, it's easy, I find, in talking to my friends, it's easy for freelancers, people trying to do this creative life, whatever that means, it's right. easy to become distracted.
Sure.
And when you become distracted, you end up getting frustrated, and then it's easy to get depressed, and it's easy to feel
podcasts
like it's easy to feel like you're not going anywhere.
Sure.
Or like you're not accomplishing anything. So for me, these types of tools help a lot, and finding one that I can grab onto kind of reminds me of some of the tools that I've used in the past and let go of for one reason or another.
Right. But you seem to swing pretty wildly from one end of the spectrum to the other, in the sense that here you are today saying, I have a plan, I have these things laid out, I have all this thing. But, you know, 4 weeks ago, the infamous episode where you were rock bottom.
What Freddie called the come to Jesus episode.
The come to Jesus episode. So it's you sort of like, it seems like you go from absolutely no confidence in your process to almost blind confidence in the process.
I still don't have a lot of confidence in the process.
Okay.
Well, I take that back. I don't have a lot of confidence in the end product. The process of getting A to B, process is something I have yes, infinite confidence in, because I think it's driven by something beyond me.
Okay.
It's when I think I'm in control that I break down. It's when I think I can actually exert any measurable control over the universe that things fall apart.
Okay. But the process that you put weight on, for lack of a better word.
Yep.
Do you actually trust it, or is trusting it just a crutch so that, you know what I'm saying? Like, do you really think that it works on itself, or is it just sort of a mental trick to get
First of all, we'll define what you're talking about.
I don't know. Okay, I'm going to make lists and define my tribe and all these things in this book. Are those tools that actually change things, or is it just that your mind thinks that things are different and therefore your mind gets working in a way that it would even without the lists? It's just sort of a way to get it jump-started.
I think they really work for me.
Okay. Yeah.
I think they work.
Yeah. It may be, and I guess this is where I was going with all this, is that for some people, it's about 10-year goals or lifetime goals or whatever it is. For some people, it's about 1-year goals. For some people, it's about 1-day goals.
Sure.
For some people, it's about not knowing what the goals are at all and seeing where life leads them, or any combination of these.
I think there has to be a plan somewhere. I don't think
for who, for everybody?
Yes. I think that there has to be things there needs to be things to focus on that move you forward. I don't know anyone who is just going willy-nilly through life.
I know a lot of people who are going willy-nilly through life.
Well, let me finish the sentence.
Okay.
I don't know anybody that's going willy-nilly through life that feels like they are in some semblance of forward momentum.
True, but again, I also know a lot of people who have a plan, quote unquote, and are miserable. So that's therein lies the rub that I can't quite, you know.
It sounds like I'm using this as a justification to participate, and you're finding ways to justify not doing it because you don't like the idea of goals.
Oh, I have tried goals numerous times and they've never worked for me, is what it is. Or rather, it's like, sure, there are times when I'm just like, you know what, I'm going to do this thing and, you know, work on this project for a month and do this series of pictures or whatever it is. And if I just, if it spontaneously pops into my head and I go, you know what, screw it, I'm just going to do this thing for 30 days or whatever it is, and I do it, that's one thing. But if I sit down and go, where should I be in 30 days or 60? Like, that never works for me. Like,
okay.
The goal has to come before the plan.
Okay. Let's take your,
as it were.
You just said it. You're putting up, let's take this recent body of pictures that you're putting up.
Okay.
In your corner. Yeah. Okay. Even though nobody puts baby in a corner.
No one puts baby in the corner.
Nobody. Okay. So you're putting up these pictures, right? Yeah. What's the point of them? Is it an exercise?
Yeah, it's an exercise.
What are you trying to work through? What is it that you're trying to do with these pictures? Because I know enough about you to know that you don't do anything for naught.
I honestly am just trying to see if the corner is going to work as a background. That's really what these are. And just to shoot when I don't feel like shooting. You know, that's mm-hmm. what it's about. Where it's going, I have no idea where it's going, you know?
So these are exercises. I don't feel like shooting today, but I need to put up.
I have time in the next month. I'm going to start shooting in the corner just to get the muscles flowing again. Yeah.
Are there technical challenges that you're giving yourself? Are there aesthetic challenges that you're giving yourself?
I'm playing with, I don't think about what I do like that. I don't have a list of the six different lighting setups I'm going to play with.
Then how do you know whether you're getting better, whether you're learning, whether you're refining? If there's no structure to anything, you just go, well, I think I'll put a light here today.
Because I look at the pictures and I say, I either like that or I don't like that. There is no objective meter of, you know, how good the lighting is in this. Oh, this is a 9.2 and I wanted a 9.4. Like, that doesn't exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I can say whether or not I find things that I find pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can say whether I think that the picture I took of somebody is a nice portrait of them. Is it, did I build this corner in order to break into some new world of stuff that I'm going to shoot? No. Well, this is a very, very conservative place to shoot, but it's built as a conservative place to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are other things, like I did that thing for Creative Mornings a few weeks ago. That went up the other day, like that was a real pain in the ass to make. So that was really hard. And I didn't know how I was going to do it while I was doing it. But this stuff, this is me trying to spend time with subjects in a very contained space to see what comes out of it. You know, it's mm-hmm. a test tube is what it is. Okay. And that's the way I think about it. So, you know, as I go on, will I become more,
okay, but you just defined kind of a project, which some could interpret as a goal.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is to throw myself and somebody else into this corner and see what comes out. Mm-hmm. But it is not, there isn't a definitive goal of I'm going to learn some new lighting technique, you know, because I don't know where it's going to lead me. Right now, I've been using a single light with these people. You know, will I pull out another light and try some stuff? Yeah, maybe I will today when, you know, my friend CC comes over. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's also a danger in creating a situation where you're always chasing something and you're never happy where you are.
Hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
I do. I think there are those that would make the case that say
the opposite.
Then you're not growing. You're just.
Well, I think that I think that by definition you're growing.
Why?
Because you're living life and you're getting new experiences.
Okay. But let's say using your corner.
Yeah.
You've got the light in roughly the same spot for every picture in here.
Actually it's in two of them, I have the light in the same spot. The rest. No.
I'm just saying. Let's say you've got a light there.
Yeah.
And the only thing that changes is the subject.
Yeah.
There are people that would argue with you that that's not really doing anything. It's not growing because you're not trying anything new. You're not refining. It's not even iterative. All you're changing is the subject matter.
Okay. Well, those people can work on their own projects. I'm not here to make other people happy. I'm here to make me happy. Right.
That's not, no, 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 that's, you're, oh, no, 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 no. You are there, and you've said this before, you are there to make the people that hire you, you work for them.
Oh, sure, those people, but these people aren't hiring me.
But isn't it all part of the same continuum?
Doesn't this
all contribute to your body of work?
When I work with, when people hire me to take their picture, and I take pictures that make them happy but don't make me happy, I do not like those jobs, and I don't want to work with that person again if they're the kind of person who pushes me in that direction. Because that doesn't interest me. What interests me is somebody wanting me for the kinds of pictures that I take, and if we end up in the same place where they want what I'm trying to make for them, that's the ideal.
But why? Okay, but why are you the end all be all?
I never said I'm the end all be all.
No,
why am I the goal? Why is my happiness the goal?
No, you just said if they end up where you are, then that's better. But why does it have to be that way? Why isn't it that the art director or the photo editor suggests something that maybe you don't like, but you end up seeing the photos and going, oh, you know what? I wouldn't have done it that way, but that's really great.
Oh, sure. Look, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that if somebody suggests something and it's a good idea, we don't go that direction. That happens all the time. But if I don't like where it went and they still use it anyway, and which has happened before, it doesn't upset me. Well, it upsets me because I'm just like, oh, it would have been better had they used this other one that we've worked on and done. I'm not against collaboration. What I'm against is being a robot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here, light it this way, shoot it this way, do what I say. It's like, well, then why did you hire me? You could have hired anyone to do this. You know, you want me or you want to hire any one of your friends because those people are because you want what they do. Otherwise, you would go to somebody else, you know. And that's okay because there are people who want what I make and there are people who want what, you know, Duchemin makes and there are people who want what whoever else makes, you know, hopefully. And so if you feel like you are growing as an artist and you are doing work that makes you happy, you know, then we're also looking on a very short time scale. You know, you may think that, oh, well, these three pictures by you all look the same that you took last week. Well, yeah, I took them last week, you know, all within 3 days of each other. If you do three paintings in 3 days, they're going to feel the same because you're at the same point in your life.
Right.
Where if you're looking over a year or 3 years or 5 years, like we talked about last week, where you're going back in your Lightroom catalog and looking at stuff you did 3 years ago.
Right.
A lot of it's going to feel very different.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of what's so cool about it is that There is this really slow glacial evolution that happens, whether you like it or not. You know? Like, sure, you could want to change and create all these new things, but like and sometimes there are jumps where you suddenly happen upon some lighting setup or some, you know, place or some technique and you're like, oh my God, this is awesome. And you do that for the next 6 months.
Right.
And I've done that myself before. You know, especially with like post-processing and stuff, but there's the slow evolution and then there's the fast stuff, you know. There was a book by, who's the guy who wrote, Michael Crichton, right?
I don't know what you're talking about. There's a book by, who's
Wait,
the guy
it was either
that wrote
Michael Crichton or might've been that Greg Bear, Darwin's Radio. Anyway, where the argument in the book was that human evolution, like the Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, evolution is, there's of course there's always this gradual thing going, but every once in a while genes sort of split in a certain way that there are these leaps in the course of a couple generations.
It sounds like something from Jurassic Park.
Yeah, but naturally so. Like all of a sudden, like a generation will be born that will be different, slight more different than the last than normal. And that will like head off in a new direction. It was a sci-fi thing. But the point is that, you know, sometimes artistically you have an inspiration that changes your style. And other mm-hmm. times it's about exploring your style, trying to find where the boundaries are, and then finding a boundary and pushing on it. But I don't think that it's always necessarily about trying to find something different every single time.
Right. Maybe goals just don't work for you.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe you are one of these people for whom your career, your art, your craft, whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
has to be a natural evolution. I just can't imagine functioning that way. I can't imagine not having a direction that I want to see, but then giving over a lot of the control to getting there.
Well, I think my problem is I don't know what the direction is, so I don't know which way to push, even if mm-hmm, I wanted to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, to start that inertia.
I really don't know where I would be. You know, it's like, stick me out in a field in Kansas. It's like, what direction you want to go? I have no freaking right. idea. It's all corn in every direction as far right. as I can see.
Right.
I have no idea. Where are the mountains? I guess maybe they're over there, or do I even want to go to the mountains? Maybe I want to go to the ocean, you know? Like, I really don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, I guess if I had certain economic goals, you know, there are certain choices I could make. If I said I wanted to, you know, own a house by the time I was 42 and I want to, you know, whatever goals right. that people have, like those in some, I think sometimes people fixate on those sort of acquisition goals, whether it's degrees or children or whatever it is, because those are very easy to define, you know? And I'm not saying that people don't actually want those things. I'm sure they do. But like, it's also this idea that, oh, that's something, there's a binary thing there. You know, do I have a master's degree or not? Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And so, but those are the people that I find, like, once they have the degree and the kid and the job are just sort of, then they're adrift because it's like, now what, you know?
Right.
And so there has to be something else there. And I feel like a lot of people say something was their goal after they've already achieved it, because then it's like, oh, I was working for this promotion for years. It's like, well, were yeah. you, or did you just happen to get the promotion and now you're trying to justify the hard work you did or whatever, you know?
I will tell you now, I don't have a 10-year goal.
Yeah.
I feel less like I am treading water than I did a few months ago.
Okay.
Now maybe I'm clinging to random bits of wreckage, you know, but I feel like there is some internal momentum, that I can not only act on, but I can quantify.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you are one of those people who need that kind of structure.
Loosely, but yeah. 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 Because if I can't look back and go, you at least did this, this, and this, then it's very easy for me to get into a what's the point mode.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's, I mean, and I get there all the time. And then that leads me to, okay, well, let's say, what is the point? Well, let's try to make some goal. Like, what is it that I'm trying to achieve?
Right.
And ultimately, the only answer that I've come up with that makes any sense always is to be happy and do something that I enjoy doing. Because mm-hmm. everything else is a subdivision of that, you know? Why do I want a house? Well, so I can feel more secure, so I can be happy in what I'm doing and what I'm, you know, why do I want? So it's all, so every, that being my goal, I don't know if it's a smart thing. I don't know if it's a stupid thing, you know?
Right.
I guess people weight things differently too. You know, for some people, like we've had people who write into the show and say, well, I always wanted to, blah, blah, blah. But I couldn't because, you know, I have kids and I need a job and a mortgage and whatever it is.
Right.
So in some ways they've decided at some point in their life that those things are more important than whatever it is they say that they, you know, that having the wife and kids and house is more important than being a photographer full time. And that's a perfectly rational, perfectly reasonable thing. In fact, it's probably a very smart thing.
Yes, but there are those who for whom you can have both things. In fact,
sure.
Kingsley, who sent me this book, Kingsley exists in both worlds, and he's going to be an upcoming guest on Process Driven. He is on the one hand, he is, I want to get this right. I think he is the executive director of mental health
right in
Perth, Western Australia. So that's his day job.
Yeah.
But he's also a fine art photographer who is selling, you know, hundreds of pieces at a time to, you know, German hotel chains and art buyers are buying his work. And so he's got this foothold in both worlds. But he'll tell you it's only been in the last 6 months where he's really comfortable, and it's not even comfortable. It's just able to manage.
Yeah.
And I said, now it sounds like you've found a balance between the two. And he laughed and said, no, there is no balance. There's always tension between the two.
Yes.
You just have to find at which point that tension, you know, sort of needs to meet. And that's where you try and live. You try and put yourself at that sort of apex of tension between the two worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and for him that works, right? And you know, but and
it
who
works
knows
now.
If, right. It didn't, yeah, it may not have worked a year ago. It may not work
been
a year
doing
from
this,
now.
Yeah. He's been doing this for 8 years, and he says it's only in the last 6 months that it's worked, and big air quotes in worked.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think that is the other thing which makes it difficult, maybe what I'm doing or what you're doing or what anybody else is doing will lead to whatever it is they think. It just hasn't yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem, is that like you can't, there's four dimensions, right? There's what you're doing, and then there's time.
Sure.
And
multiply that by our you know, compulsion / addiction to wanting certainty in our lives.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like that's in some ways my way of doing things eschews security in many
sure.
ways. And that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. It makes me uncomfortable too, but it makes me less uncomfortable than feeling trapped in a situation where I don't have any sort of, it's funny, I was about to say control.
Right.
And it's like, I don't really have control now, but at least my hands are on the reins.
Right.
You know, where if I was sitting in the back of the bus, that would be a very different, you know, if I'm sitting in the back of the wagon and somebody else is driving, even if it's a nice secure thing and I know I'm going to get to the end in one piece, it's like it's not nearly as interesting to me, because then, you know, the one problem with the goal thing is that you're, in some ways, it's making the goal seem to be more apparent than the journey. And we have said so many times that it's the journey that's interesting. You know,
yeah,
we've been watching one last thing and then we'll get on to all this news crap. We've been watching this show Continuum.
Yeah.
Have you seen this show?
I've watched probably 3 or 4 episodes. I'm not a fan.
Yeah. It's silly sci-fi, whatever. But there's one guy in it who comes back in time. The whole thing is they come back in time and they're stuck there. And one of the guys decides to use his knowledge to like make lots of money. And he like lives on a boat and he's, you know, made a bunch of money in the stock market, you know, bought Google at whatever, you know, whatever the thing is.
Is his name Biff?
I think his name is Kellogg actually, but yeah, it's cute. You know, there's always that thing. And then, but I was thinking about it. I was like, okay, great. Yeah. $50 million, let's say, right? Now what? Okay. You could sit around. Or what are you probably going to do? You're probably going to find some other goal in which to strive for, right? And, you know, if my goal is to make portraits of people that make them happy and make me happy in the process and enjoy the process of taking them, and in the meantime, make enough money to pay the rent and go on a vacation once a year, why is that a bad goal? You know what I mean? That's what I think in my head. Because at least, and of course there's other goals in there, but if that's the draw, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, you know. At least I have a thing that I'm working towards, a general color, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
If not a definitive goal, I don't know.
Okay, so somebody asks you,
mm-hmm.
in one sentence, what is your current goal as a photographer?
I don't know how I'd answer that, but I don't know how anybody else would answer that either.
We're talking about everybody else. You're a big fan of like, whoa, what would you do? I don't know what anybody else would do. I'm asking you. This is our show. I'm asking
what's,
you.
What's my goal as a photographer? I want to take pretty portraits. That's what I want to do. And anything other than that is me just pontificating, you know, is me just.
So then that's a goal and that's a benchmark.
Sure.
So anything that doesn't.
But it's subjective.
Why is it subjective?
It's what I think is pretty. You know, I could think anything's pretty.
Okay. Know? But you're the guy with the hammer and chisel.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. You're the guy carving the block. Yes. So you get to make that choice. So now that you've got this set out for the world to hear, I want to make pretty portraits.
Yep.
If it's not a pretty portrait, then don't put it up.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Why?
Because not every single thing I make is going to reach. Well, reach.
What
some,
was that?
That was a very loud horn on the street. Apparently.
What is it? 1932? It sounded like an Ugo horn or something.
Sorry, I had beans last night. because not everything I make is going to fit within that realm, and isn't the and I may stumble upon something that isn't pretty. That you know, it's
aha,
not.
Aha!
Sure.
Now we're getting there.
No, and I'm
now
not denying that. That yes, but that's true of everybody.
Okay, again, you're really big on bringing everybody else into the world.
No, but what I'm saying is that these are universal things that, of course, you're going to stumble upon things. But that's going to happen whether your goal is to stumble upon things or not, you know? So you know, either you have something you're leaning towards or you lean towards wherever the world takes me. It's like, well, both of those things are going to happen regardless of which one you choose,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, why choose? Just keep doing what you're doing. Stop thinking about it too much and just do it, which is what I do or what I have been doing, you know? And it leads where it leads, you know? I do what I can to talk to people and make connections and do this and that and the other thing and do the podcast and, you know, all of that stuff is true. But like if suddenly my life becomes step by step fulfilling some goal, then the goal is my boss.
I think that depends on the strength of the goal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or it depends on the nature of the goal is probably a better way to put it.
Good point. Yeah. I don't know where it is. And I think that it's just very difficult to define, especially if you separate. I mean, business goals are one thing, maybe, you know, or acquisition goals are one thing. But it's very difficult to define where you want to be from an artistic point of view, whatever that means in 10 years.
Well, I think the entire nature of business, whether you're in a quote unquote creative endeavor or not, is shifting. You know, it used to be that you got the job and you worked someplace until you got the gold watch and then, you know, then you died.
Yeah.
That was
sure.
It.
Yeah.
And
that was a good thing?
Well, I don't know that it was a good thing, but that's the way it was done.
Yeah.
Right. Even, you know, my friend Mark, his, he used to joke, because you know his father would always say, well, you know, if you were supposed to like it, they wouldn't call it work.
Yeah, but
right?
Of course.
Okay. But the world has shifted. Climate has shifted in business, and it's no longer finding a company that you can work for 40 years, because number one, that company probably won't be around for that long. But number two is it really has shifted to more about your skill set and where your skill set can be used. And if it can be used at multiple locations and multiple companies and multiple situations, then that's what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Anytime people start talking in a lot of the words that you tend to like the Seth Godin-y kind of words to describe things. To me,
like
tribe, you know, it's
tribe's
like
a great word.
Yeah, I know. You like that word.
It's
to
a
me,
great
I feel like you could find examples of where tribe is completely useful and completely useless all at the same time, in which case the word tribe to me means everything and nothing. It means what I want it to mean, in which case it doesn't really mean it doesn't convey anything to me. It's like there's lots of like it's words for word's sake that doesn't actually propel anything forward other than in your own head to me. That's what it feels like.
And you would put tribe in one of those.
Well, it's a lot of these sort of I feel like the self-help book world has been around for 100 years and it'll be around for another 100 years, and obviously no one's found the answer, or else that would be the one everyone read and figured everything out. You know, and I've read lots of them, and it's never seemed to, that is never, whatever tools that they give you in those have never been what has actually made the difference in my life. And maybe it does for other people, but like for me, it feels like pyrite, you know, it's like, oh no, this is the answer. And it's like, well, you know,
I think they want you to think
that's the answer because they want to sell you the book.
I think if you're reading something that says this is the answer, it's the wrong thing to read. I think if you're reading something that says this is an answer,
yeah,
that's a shift. That's yeah, that. Maybe. That's what works. And in terms of tribe, I think the listeners are my tribe.
Well, sure. I think
the people that read, you know, Faded and Blurred regularly are the tribe. And those are they support what you do. They tell you when you're screwing up. They hold you accountable.
Absolutely. But I don't, but by putting the word tribe on them, I feel like that deflates their meaning in the much the same way that I say that like in defining my friendship with you, somehow it's like, I don't need to define my friendship with you. It is what it is. You know, like I don't need to make lists of what Jeffrey means to me because Jeffrey means a lot to me. You mm-hmm. see what I'm saying? Like, I think that's part of my problem with it is that by defining it and putting it in a box, it's actually taking away from it for me.
Okay. Okay.
And I don't know. Well, whatever. We can move on from this. People are probably bored.
They're not bored. This is interesting.
It's a good conversation.
This is riveting. Come on now.
I don't know.
All right. So what? We're gonna talk about Jeff Koons.
Hey, you put it in this thing.
I know.
Well, look. How about people let us know what you think? podcast@ontakingpictures.com. And
do you have goals?
Yeah.
Answer the question. Yeah. Do you have goals? What type of goals do you set? Oh, see, you didn't even remember. Next week, Q&A show.
Yeah, we're going to do a Q&A show.
So get them into podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
Yeah. Or leave a voicemail because I can cut those in.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That would be fun.
If you want to do a voicemail. Yeah.
347-687-9411 and leave a message on our voicemail and if we choose one of those questions, we'll put it in. That would be a fun way to get the questions.
Yeah.
So do that if you can.
All right. So
let's do some news.
What do you think of Jeff Koons? talking about big gigantic
balloon
artists.
Dogs.
No, no, just,
made
well,
of
that,
mud, and, made of metal, shiny
and
metal.
Popeye. You know?
I think that Jeff people like Jeff Koons because Jeff Koons is making stuff that can be labeled art with a capital A, but is accessible by anybody because he's just stealing stuff from...
It's accessible by anybody with millions and millions of dollars.
Well, I mean, accessible to... People can look at that and say, look, I like art because I like a Popeye that looks like a big balloon, whatever it is, you know, because they like Popeye. It has nothing to do with whether or not they think that is important art. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? I think that he is an excellent marketer and he feeds that world. And I think this article on Phaedon.com, what does it say? If you don't like Jeff Koons, maybe you don't like culture. Don't like your culture.
Yeah. What do you think of your culture? In judging Jeff, you need to answer the question. What do you think of your culture? I
like my culture fine. I don't like him like stealing it to make a lot of money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, no, I don't think those things are, I think those things are mutually exclusive.
But you'll keep watching the Big Bang Theory, won't you?
Oh, Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
$1 million an episode, Jeffrey.
This is ridiculous.
Those people are making probably more money than Jeff Koons.
Ridiculous. $90 million over the next 3 years?
No, yeah. But like, okay.
What I think is great is how much they're giving to the writers.
Yeah.
Nothing. Thanks for that, you guys.
But look anyway. look at the picture that is in this article. You know, the big egg,
the Brillo open, boxes.
Right? Or yeah, okay, well, the Brillo boxes are Warhols, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
But that I don't get either.
Yeah, that I don't get either. I don't get Duchamp's urinal. I'm just like that stuff.
So
just
I could
sort
go into the Amazon warehouse, snap a photograph, or arrange some Amazon boxes in a certain manner, and that's art.
I mean, Kunz's stuff, at least the people he's hiring. Like, okay, I have some idea that I want to build a giant egg out of metal. Like, finding the people who can actually do that and make it look that good, that's impressive just from a logistical point of view.
Sure, sure, from a craft standpoint.
Yeah,
sure.
Craft-wise, they're beautiful. Conceptually, then, like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I think what, but do you understand what I'm trying to say is that, like, for somebody who's not into art, they could go see a Jeff Koons thing and all of the objects are based upon things in their normal life that they can understand and don't have to think that much about. Oh, it's a giant balloon animal.
Right.
Okay. That's neat. Look, he made a giant balloon animal. Who's he made this? Oh, I like Jeff Koons.
Yeah.
You know,
I've never, balloon dog.
Great.
I've never really connected with his stuff. I you know, in terms of modernism I prefer Tim Hawkinson. You know, I
prefer Richard Serra.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know, but
it's so just interesting. Interesting.
It's interesting in the sense that he's basically he or she. Who is this? She, he, whatever. Is basically equating popular culture with Jeff Koons, and it's like no. Popular culture is one thing. Jeff Koons is co-opting popular culture to make big art that makes him a lot of money from rich people. That doesn't mean that they're the same thing.
I also have a hard time when the artist himself or herself is so far removed from the process of actually making the art.
Well, Richard Serra didn't build his own stuff.
I know. And I really have a hard time with a lot of that.
Yeah.
I have a hard time with you're an architect, you're not a builder. I don't know where I come down on that sometimes. I tend to like the idea of hand to conte to paper, or hand to brush to paper, or hand to clay. You know what I mean? I tend to prefer the idea of a more direct contact with what you're creating.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you. Although things are, of course, on this level require teams of people.
Sure.
Whatever. We'll put the link in the show notes. Okay. So there's a rumor that Nikon's going to use the same 50 megapixel sensor that Pentax is using in the 645Z and, what's it called? Phase is using in the 180, whatever IQ or whatever it is.
Somebody's going to go medium format, and really nobody knows who it is yet, or nobody in the public that can share it knows who it is yet.
You mean one of the either Canon or Nikon's going to?
Maybe, or maybe Fuji or Sigma.
Yeah. Okay. I gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So the idea is that they're going to take that sensor and stick it in something else and start making like a crazy mirrorless, you know, be kind of cool actually would be, something akin to the, what was that camera? Mamiya 6 or Mamiya 7? You know, the rangefinder?
Oh, yeah, 6-7s. Yeah.
Make something like that where it's a 1.5-inch thick box that's, you know, 3x4 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That has maybe even a rangefinder and just optical rangefinder and button. That would be a cool camera.
Interesting.
I don't know that anybody would ever do it. They'd probably stick a stupid EVF in it, but that would be really cool.
Well, they probably will.
It would have to be a really good EVF. Do you think it's going to happen? And do you think it will make any difference?
Not really.
Because Zach Arias says all we need is cell phones because it's about your brain.
And I think to a large degree, he's right on that point. Yes. It is about your brain.
It is. So why do you even need the Fuji? How about just use your phone if it's all about the brain?
I use my phone more than I use.
No,
anything
I'm
else.
Just saying about Zach. It's just like,
I think these are, if the problem with medium format is I think it's going to be ridiculously expensive.
Yeah. Okay, what is, here's a question. What is a price low enough that medium format not makes sense for you, but makes sense for the market to you, in your opinion?
I think probably the current, to make sense for the market and to make sense for to numbers wise.
Yeah.
I think the sweet spot is somewhere around $2,000.
$2,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's going to be a while. Those sensors are expensive.
Well, they're expensive because they don't make very many of them.
Yeah. True. Well, and they're also a bigger part of the wafer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These things are made like chips, right? So if it takes up twice the area, it's going to be twice as expensive as the one that takes up half the area.
Is there a way to I wonder, use an array of smaller sensors?
Yeah, but overlap the seams somehow?
Maybe, or just interpolate them via I mean, even if they weren't overlapped.
Yeah, like that's sort of like what they're doing with optical telescopes now, where they have like six telescopes. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, kind of the mirrors are all sort of honeycomb shape.
And maybe it'll go that direction. I don't
tiled
know.
Sensors.
Look, I think that it's interesting that, I mean, there were, wow, what is wrong with me today?
You're having a tough time.
There are rumors.
You didn't have your fizzy water. That's what it is.
I don't have fizzy water, actually.
Ah!
I ran out of fizz, and they were closed yesterday. The Canon, there were a number of rumors that Canon was going to be working on a larger sensor camera. For the last year and a half, there have been rumors on Canon doing the same thing. So I don't know. We'll see. I'd love one of these things. I just can't afford the $10,000 to buy the one that I'd want.
Put four full frame sensors in an array.
Yeah. The problem is you'd need four lenses, right?
Why?
Well, because the lens is projecting a circle of whatever it is, and unless you somehow have the sensors overlapping, there's always going to be spaces in between that you're not getting the information for.
Yeah.
So you're sticking yourself.
They're clever. They can figure it out.
They are. Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to move this one up because we should talk about this next. And I know you're going to be upset about this one.
It's that Lytro.
Yeah. So the Verge did a review of the big Lytro. Because Lytro, if you guys remember, is this camera that supposedly captures a light field. Is that what they call it?
Sure. Sure.
Basically, it's capturing. It doesn't really focus on anything. What it does is just sort of grabs everything and then focuses later by doing a lot of post processing. I don't know the exact technology in this. I'm sure there's a Wikipedia article we can link to. But they had that little tiny box camera that looked like a kaleidoscope.
Right.
Remember that one they made a couple years ago? Now they have like a big camera, which kind of looks like an SLR.
A really poorly designed.
Sure. Cost $1,500. And, I feel about Lytro the same way that I feel about the whole animated GIF thing, where it's like, okay, yeah, it's neat, but that's it. It's neat. You know what I mean? Like, it's never going to be the mainstream because now I need a computer to see the damn picture.
Okay. I could see where this could be a useful technology for, say, scientific applications.
Sure. Yep.
I could see where this would be a great thing for those photographers who are doing sort of focus stacked macro work.
Yeah, but the thing is that on any particular layer that you click to refocus on, the maximum you're going to get out of it is the equivalent of a 4-megapixel image.
Yeah. So
it's like, okay, so I'm spending $1,500 on this camera and the pictures I can only view on the web, or I can pull out stills from these light fields, but the most I'm going to get out is half what I get from my iPhone.
Yeah. I don't get it.
Yeah. And again, you're right. If for special, special effect kind of photography, yeah, there might be an argument for it.
Don't see where this is a consumer product at all.
No, either do I. And apparently each image that you only remember get 4 megapixels out of is 53 megabytes. It takes 30 seconds to import and 5 seconds to open. So it's like, That's a big... Anyway, they gave it a 5.7 on The Verge. Although they said all this... They were just like, it's really neat. And their headline is the Litro Ilum camera. This is the camera of the future.
No, it's not.
It's almost time to forget everything you ever knew about photography, says David Pierce.
Yeah, with a 5.7.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sharknado 2 will change the way you look at cinema forever.
No. Oh, God, it's just so awful. Anyway, no. If anybody's actually played with one of these Litros and wants to argue for them, let us know, because I think it's neat. Now, hold on a second. You know what? While we're here...
Well, wait a minute.
What you were going to say?
I was just going to say, Kingsley has the first gen one, and I asked him what he thought of it. He said, I got it when it first came out. He said he might have used it 2 or 3 times, and it just sits on his desk.
Yes. Okay, there you go. But then there's the Foveon sensors that are in some of those cameras, including... What's the little DP2 thing that...
The DP2, which, again, it's like Kingsley's show today. He's got one.
Oh, he's the one who has one of those, too.
Yeah. Okay. He sent me a couple, how big is this thing?
And some people swear by those, but you're also in those getting about a 4-megapixel image out. It's just that the pixels are
great. Not a 4-megapixel image. It's a 29 megapixels.
This is out of the DP2?
Yeah.
All right.
3616 by 5424.
3616 by 5424. Interesting, because they say, this is from the DP2. It says here that it's a 14 megapixel image, but then I've read other places that say, because the Foveon sensor doesn't actually have a sensor for each one of those.
Okay, the way it works is the sensor captures light in 3 layers.
Yes.
Okay. The top layer.
But the sensor itself is only 26 by 17.
Right. The top layer it only sees blue light.
Right.
Okay. And that's the largest megapixel, if you will, capture. The next layer down captures green light, which is weird because I always thought we were more sensitive to green, but whatever.
Yeah.
So the next layer down captures green, and then the final layer captures red.
Right.
But those green and red layers are a lower megapixel count, and they're interpolated than the blue.
Right. So it's doing a different interpolation than a Bayer sensor, but it's still interpolating.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's if that is so great, right, Foveon. There was a time at which that was supposed to take the world by storm. Remember, like, 8 years ago, whatever it is when it first came out? Everyone said, these Foveon sensors are going to change the world and the new way of looking at photography. And they're in 3 cameras and have been in 3 cameras for 10 years.
Okay, but look at Fuji. Fuji's got a different...
Yes, but theirs is pretty slick different in the sense that it's, we're just like...
And they're the only ones making any money.
Well, basically, they make a Bayer sensor that is randomized so that they don't need an anti-alias filter in front of it so the images can be sharper, which is actually a really slick idea. I still don't know how the hell they do it.
Well, but it's not a Bayer sensor.
Yeah, but it's still a red, green, blue thing that interpolates the pixels. It's just it's just that the red and green and blue are in sort of a random pattern on it, so therefore you don't get more A and that kind of stuff if you don't have the AA filter.
Right.
I don't know. It's just, it's interesting. It's like they came out with this, the first Foveon sensor came out in 2002. So 12 years later, and it still hasn't really made much of a scratch. I wonder why.
No idea.
Yeah. Anyway, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
So anyway, all these different things. Again, everyone, all these cameras are going to take great pictures, except for the Litro.
Yes. Hey, any camera you buy is going to take great pictures. Except the Litro.
Unless it's a Litro.
Yeah.
Hey, we're so terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to get a knock on the door. Litros, jackbooted thugs are going to be like, hey, that's right. Wadman.
Yeah. No. They don't knock. They just smash through the windows like a Minority Report off the roof.
Yeah. They're going to rappel down the side of your building.
Hey, Instagram collides with gaming. So people are using Last of Us as a feature. Yeah. Where you can take pictures. Is this basically
the PS4. Okay, so Last of Us.
Is this the zombie game?
No, well, sort of, yeah. Probably my favorite game I've ever played.
Okay, so I should get a PS4 just to play this game with Heather?
No. It's the PS4 version is a remastered version of the PS3 version. So okay. It still hasn't been developed for the PS4. You're not going to see any really amazing looking PS4 games for a while yet. Maybe Assassin's Creed. That'll be pretty amazing. Assassin's Creed Unity. Anyway, so what they've done in the PS4 version of The Last of Us is they've added a photo mode. So at any point during the game, you can enter photo mode and now you are controlling a camera in the world, and you can change the focal length, you can change depth of field, there are post-processing effects, there are, you know, vignettes, filters. So basically
you're using the environment and the engine as a world creator that then you're going around and taking pictures
yes.
of it.
Yes.
That's a neat
and
idea.
And then you're posting, you know, these things to their site. It's kind of gimmicky, but then again, it's also kind of cool.
Now, are they doing this as a marketing thing, or do they imagine that you would do this, then share it on social media, and that would make people want to buy the game? Is that
I think that's probably the arc, you know, of how they'd like it to work. Like, oh, look how cool this is. But it's interesting that you are this sort of street photographer / photojournalist in a post-apocalyptic world that doesn't exist.
That's a neat idea. It's funny. It's like I see this as more as photography than a lot of things that people think is photography. You know, somehow this seems like it's more work than a lot of the Instagram stuff that normally goes up.
Well, look, you're still framing a shot.
Yep.
You're still deciding which moment that you want to.
I like the quote by one of the game makers who was just like, we look at a lot of them and go, that's our game? or something like that. They're so,
It is a gorgeous game, to be fair. It is, and it's tense, and the story, the writing is fantastic.
Yeah, the poll quote, we've been surprised at some of the shots that people get. We look at them and say, wow, is that even our game?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Last week they did a live reading in Santa Monica. They had Neil Druckmann there, who's the director of the game. They had the composer there, they had all the actors from the game, and they did live readings of specific scenes punctuated with cut scenes from the game. I wish I could have been there, but I didn't find out about it until afterward.
Wow, that's seriously nerdy. I love it.
It's kind of neat, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like you're showing up to see voice actors in a game that you played.
Yeah, sitting in director's chairs, holding an SM57, reading the video game script.
It's kind of cool.
That's meta.
Yeah, I really wish I could have been there. Anyway, so we'll put a link in the show notes.
All right, that is pretty cool. Hey, so it's all right, Jeffrey. Kodak is going to make movie film for the next few years.
I think that's good.
Yeah. Because
otherwise Chris Nolan would quit the game.
Yeah, I guess the idea is that Chris Nolan and Tarantino and somebody else, a couple
probably,
other people.
Probably Marty Scorsese, maybe.
Yeah, have basically pushed their studios into telling Kodak that they will, and Apatow and some other people,
Apatow, whose work really benefits from the beauty of film.
Well, hey, says you. I don't know. I've never been a big fan of his films, but sure.
Yeah.
But except for wait, he did Superbad, didn't he? No,
he did. No.
No, he didn't.
He did 40-Year-Old Virgin.
See, that's why Superbad is good, because he didn't do it. Anyway, moving on. They basically said that they will buy movie film for the next 2 years. Is that what it is? Two, three years? They basically promised, you know, we're going to put in a buy for the next 2 years, that we're going to buy whatever.
Kind of like what Southwest did for fuel.
Did they? Yeah, oh, they bought in for a couple years?
Pre-bought. That's why it's one of the reasons their fares are really low. They bought in gas at a lower price.
You can do that with like oil and stuff when you live in a place where you need oil for heat. When I was a kid, my parents used to do that. Anyway, so apparently film accounts for less than 10% of Kodak's $2.2 billion worth of revenue. And they have charts in this article talking about how in 2006 sales of motion picture film were about 12.5 billion, and now they are 400 million.
Yeah.
So it's down to 5% of what it was in 2006, 2007. In fact, it's down almost since 2009. It's down to 5% of what it was.
Yeah.
That is crazy. Unbelievable.
Isn't Abrams shooting Star Wars on 70 millimeter?
Yeah.
And Interstellar shot on 70 millimeter as well?
Well, if Nolan did it, then it probably is. Yeah. So, I mean, look, it's cool. I'm just saying that, you know, this is the fact that they have to do this, you know, no, please Kodak, keep making film. We'll promise to buy it for the next two. We'll promise to buy X amount for the next 2 years if you keep making it.
Right.
You know? Yeah. It's, oh, you know, I had it wrong. Not dollars. It was 12 billion linear feet down to 449 million linear feet.
Ah, okay.
And Kodak left the movie film business last year, or Fuji did. So Kodak's the only one left. It's fascinating. It's like, it's the last sort of, you know, get your boxes while you can. You know, the guy, Tarakov that I hung out with yesterday, he was saying how he used to shoot Kodachrome all the time and used to buy so much of it that it ended up being like a dollar a roll.
Wow.
And that he used to, you know, put it in the freezer, buy batches and put it in the freezer. But he found that the color in the Kodachrome film was best and most consistent right around the expiration date. So he would buy film and just hold on to it for 2-3 years.
Wow.
And then use it when it was about to expire.
Interesting.
And so when he charged clients for film and processing, part of it would be the refrigeration fee of holding onto it for 2.5 years.
No real cold storage fee.
Yeah. And some guy called him up one day and was just like, look, it costs you $6 to do a roll of film. Like, why are you charging me 20? And he's just like, because I have to buy this stuff. I have to have a freezer. I have to hold onto it for 2 years. I've got to pay for, you know, whatever it is. He's like, look, if you want to bring me film and you want to take the film out and get it processed, like, more power to you, but I will not guarantee the quality of the results.
Wow.
Where I will, if, you know what I mean? And I was like, that's actually kind of cool. I don't know. It's kind of neat. Anyway, interesting stuff that, hey, Kodak, just for 2 more years.
Yeah.
We're going to be all right. Somebody sent this in, the single print for 35 grand. Who sent that in? It was one of our...
One of the listeners sent it in. Yeah. Maybe Ryan? Ryan, was it?
I'll find it. But go ahead. So what's the deal with this?
Well, first of all, I think it needs a few more watermarks on it so nobody steals it.
It was Alan Bellward.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
No, I mean, thanks, Alan. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Look at the watermarks. Is that a joke?
I don't know. Okay, Greg, we get it. It's your picture. Yeah.
Well, I guess he's got to do that because even this version that he's showing people to sell the image can't get out too much. You know, no one can make a print of this one or else he'd be in trouble. So the guy took a picture from the air of Cape Town, right?
Right.
The bottom tip of Africa with Table Mountain there in the background, which my sister has hiked, but I never have gotten to. And he's making one print. Does he say how big the print is? I don't see it in there. Okay,
it's a stitched 40 megapixel image.
Okay, so he's got this big image. He is making a single print of it and getting rid of all the copies. Is that true?
That's what he says.
And if you buy this single print, which is the only copy of this picture, you will also own the rights to the picture.
So you can make copies of it and sell it.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. So that's it. You know,
let's collectively buy this thing
and then
make posters of it like Avedon did with Nastasia Kinski.
We could do that. Yeah. Do people really want a picture of Cape Town from the air for that much?
I don't know.
You know, it's interesting to me. I guess the idea is when I read it, I first thought to myself, okay, this is interesting because he's selling the single print. And we've talked about this before, like, let's make false scarcity. Let's make a single print and then delete all the files so that all that exists, even though we're shooting digital, all that exists is this single piece of paper. You know?
Right.
That's kind of a, that's a neat idea. And he's sort of now done that and gotten a whole lot of social media stuff with it. I think what's interesting is that it's almost as if that isn't enough. So therefore he's just like, oh, I'm also going to sell you the rights. Yeah. Upon finalization of the sale, I will relinquish all rights to the image to the new owner. Should the new owner choose to use it, further sales or advertising, that's up to them. It'll be theirs to do with as they please. So see, it's like, it's almost like, I know the one single print and having a print on your wall probably isn't worth $35,000.
Right. So he's basically selling the rights and throwing in the print.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. He's okay. Sweetening the deal.
Yeah.
By, I don't know. What do you think? Course, interesting or uninteresting?
If you had the rights, you could print it yourself.
Yeah, interesting or uninteresting?
I think it's a gimmick.
Yeah.
You know? You know William Gibson?
Yes.
Author?
I know of William Gibson.
Okay. William Gibson, my favorite sci-fi author, and I may have mentioned this on the show. He produced a book called Agrippa, Book of the Dead.
Agrippa.
And this book was printed using graphite on paper, but it was printed in such a way that flipping through the book would cause the graphite to fall from the page. So you could only ever look through the book once.
See, that's cool.
Okay. And then they released a digital version of it that as you scroll, it erased itself. So you could even only read the digital version once. And it would delete itself as the text left the page.
Now, is
left
that the window? But okay, is that any different than this guy, or is it just that that's harder to do? Is that just as much of a gimmick?
I don't. I think the cool factor of it is a little bit because it's analog.
It's a higher.
I mean, the
cool
digital
factor.
Version, whatever. But the analog thing, like you get this knowledge, you get this wisdom, you get this whatever, but you only get it once. There's something about that I find I've romanticized that to a large degree.
Yes, you fetishize that. You love that idea.
I do.
It is a cool idea. This is a cool idea. I think it would be cooler if instead of just doing one thing, this was your standard way of working. I take landscapes, I make one print, I delete the files. All that's left is this single print, and I do, 30 of them a year. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, if I sell the rights.
Yeah, this is just, or not even sell the rights. It's like, well, I guess you could scan the print, but like, it's just the print. It's not like I'm even handing you a file. You know what I mean? Right. Like, that's it. That's interesting to me from artistic theory kind of way.
Do you run the risk of it just becoming really precious stock photography?
Well, sure, but I guess it depends what kind of pictures you take.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. Interesting.
There are people whose images we both really love that, if there was only one of them, that would you be more likely to buy it if there was only one of them? And what if there was only one of them and he sold them for $300?
Wait, what? If there was only one and he sold them? How could you sell?
I'm just saying like sold each print of each image. You know what I mean? Like let's say I was a landscape photographer and I took these pictures and $300 a piece for each image that I sold. So I didn't even, it's not like I was trying to sell them for $35,000. Like I sold them for what was a reasonable price.
I like the idea of the exclusivity of it. It just seems the way it's being presented or marketed or offered just seems really gimmicky.
False scarcity.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a weird, weird thing. Hey, this is cool. Did you see this article I put in here? So
the fake lunar landing photos were repaired by hackers. The soundstage in Burbank that was used originally was no longer available.
Okay, so in 1966. In 1966.
In a world where the U.S. faked a moon landing.
So NASA in 1966 had to figure out where they were actually going to land on the moon. So they sent satellites up called Lunar Orbiter 1, and I think there were two or three of them. And they went around the moon, and they had cameras aiming downwards and to the side, so they got those oblique shots, with 70-millimeter cameras in them. So basically like a Hasselblad inside the thing. I don't know that they were Hasselblad cameras, but that about that size of film. which took pictures, had processing inside the satellite, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
And then it scanned the image and sent it back via radio waves, right? But apparently at the time, they didn't have the expert, the technical expertise or whatever it is, to put it back together in a computer. So what they did was they sort of projected the data coming in up on a wall and took a picture of that.
Hmm.
And, or like made a printout, you know, they would print it out as it came and then put it up as strips. And it came in really blocky. Like it was good enough to do what they wanted to do, but it wasn't great quality. But it wasn't that the data coming back wasn't great quality. It was just that their interpretation of that data wasn't great at the time. However, they recorded the data coming back on Ampex tapes.
Like audio tape, basically, right?
Well, no, but at the time, this Ampex recorder would record digital data as well, up to 10 megabits per second on a rotating head. So it was like this really high-end thing at the time. And so they had these tapes, and so these guys decided they wanted to see if they could make this work. It's called the Lunar Orbiter Image Recovery Project. And since 2007, they found somebody who had one of the tape machines, the players. Some woman like had it in her garage, and some engineer woman, and they brought her in, Nancy Evans. She's a former NASA employee. So she had the tapes and apparently the drive. They went to LA, they picked up the thing, and they set up shop in an old McDonald's that they rented that was like shut down. And they pulled the data off of these tapes and reconstructed these images in a modern computer. And it's an article on CNN. We're going to put the link in the show notes.
Kind of cool.
Look at the second one where they show you what it used to look like and then what it does look like now.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I like the fourth one where it's like oblique, where they shot to the side and it shows you the mountains and stuff on the moon. Come on, that's cool.
That's great.
Anyway,
that's great.
I just think that it's kind of cool that these guys put together, they basically, processed photos from 1966 and put them back together again, you know?
Yeah.
Like this is, I just love the idea that these are probably just aerospace engineers who are retired and they had nothing else to do. And they were like, I kind of like NASA, let's figure out something to do. And then they got super nerdy about it. There's a great video in the YouTube video in here where they like show them actually running the tape machine, which is pretty cool. So anyway, we'll check that out. What else? What's next?
What do we got?
The Brian Frank thing is pretty cool.
Well, so, you know why you think it's cool.
Well, I think it's cool because he actually did it. So Brian Frank, who was a listener of the show, got inspired to make a documentary about making stuff, creative people. And he did a Kickstarter. I think we talked about it on the show, like, you know, 100 episodes ago, where he raised, I don't know, $5,000 or something like that to basically pay his way to travel around the country to go meet a bunch of people he contacted to interview them for this little 30-minute documentary he put together, which you can now watch on Vimeo, called Make Do. And
he says on July 1st, 2013, I packed up my car with the camera gear and spent 3 months driving around the U.S. as a one-man crew, interviewing all sorts of creative people. Some were friends, some were family, and many were strangers. The doc road trip took me from San Diego to New Orleans, from New York City to Missoula, from Seattle to L.A., and everywhere in between. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and he actually did it. It's actually done. You can actually watch it. And yes, I am one of the people that he interviewed. So.
Yes.
So I watched myself the other day
over and over and over
just once, actually. And I don't sound
I'm sorry.
Like,
it was Alan Bailward that watched you.
I wonder if he's watched it yet. I don't sound like a complete idiot. So, you know,
so well
good on
done,
me.
Brian.
So well done, Brian. Excellent editing.
I love that he
the
was
voiceover
inspired.
Work was fantastic. That you actually made my mouth move to your words.
Yeah, better than Glenn Close in Greystoke, Legend of Tarzan. I love that he was inspired by Casey Neistat, who I think is fantastic.
Yep. Yeah. He's so anyway. Go check out
very cool.
Go check out Make.do. And this is just
congratulations, Brian.
This is a good example of of somebody, you know, having an idea and actually following it through. And Brian,
you mean shipping, like Seth Godin would say, shipping?
Yeah. As if Seth Godin came up with the term shipping. And but what I like about this though is that Brian, it's not like Brian was a documentary filmmaker beforehand.
Right.
He just picked this up and learned. And I love doing that. It's like, I have no idea how to do this. I'm going to figure it out, you know?
Yeah, well done, Brian.
Yeah, good job. So we're going to put a link in the show notes. Hey, Adobe put out a white paper about transitioning from Aperture to Photoshop.
Can we use white paper in quotes? Because basically it's export everything you've ever done as a raw file and re-import it and reprocess it.
Yes. Yeah, if you've processed it in Aperture and you want to keep those changes, you need to export it as a TIFF.
Yeah.
So basically,
so flatten it down.
And then, but here's my best part.
Ridiculous.
The following metadata will not be transferred: color labels, flags, custom metadata fields, places, face, books, slideshows, light table. It's like, so basically what you're getting is the like sort of lowest common denominator of metadata.
You're getting what you store in cold storage.
Yes. Now here's the thing. This is what terrifies me about something going out of business. If I settled on Aperture and I used color labels to organize my entire catalog, you see what I'm saying? Yeah. And Apple stops making it. Well, what the hell? Now, you know what I mean? Like now years of work are gone. What you would have to do then is then find a way in Aperture to have it say, if it has a blue color label, also have it have this, you know, EXIF standard metadata tag
wonder,
or whatever.
I mean, look, this is Adobe's solution. I wonder if somebody out there...
Well, Adobe says that they're working on a migration tool.
Yeah. I wonder if somebody will do it. Because this is not migration. This is, you know...
Yeah. But this is the nightmare scenario. And for me, one of the reasons why I do use Lightroom and Photoshop, because I know Lightroom and Photoshop aren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know? Because we talked about using Aperture, and we talked about using, what was the Photoshop?
Capture One?
Or Capture One, even?
Yeah.
Or the Photoshop, what was the Photoshop-like app that I used for a while that was like $50 that I used for a week?
Pixelmator.
Pixelmator. It's like, Pixelmator might be around 5 years from now, or it might not be. And, you know, it's like, I don't know. But I know Photoshop will be around. And I know that sucks, and I know it gives Adobe all this power and whatever it is, but like... it's the amount of time you could have lost if this really was your only way to move things over is terrifying to me. Like, that's just scary. And one of the reasons why I don't
if you've done all the processing, you've got all these final images, in theory, you shouldn't need to do anything further to them. So why can't you just start fresh
In theory, sure. But I mean, I go back to raw files, looking up stuff that, you know, I've made even coming out of camera to get them to the point where they're in my library. I've made all kinds of, I need to bring this exposure up and open up these shadows and whatever it is. All of that's gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, you get the raw files. You didn't lose anything. You just lost everything you've lost since you took the picture.
Right.
Or possibly lose everything since you took the picture. Any processing stuff, at least. You know, and that's a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if...
I'm still holding out hope that that Photos is going to be something pretty
cool. And that's the question. I wonder how Photos will deal with having... You know, it's great if you've got 200 pictures in it, but what happens when you put 140,000 pictures in it? You know,
I don't know why...
Well, I mean, if you have your collection, so otherwise you have to like go find folders on your drive and open them up, and you know, it's supposed to be an organizational tool, right?
Right, but I don't know that the number of photos would make any difference to this new Photos app.
Well, it's some sort of library thing. I'll tell you, the amount of songs in my iTunes library makes a big difference to how iTunes runs. So why would it be, you know, the amount of pictures you put into Lightroom makes a difference.
Right. But I guess my question is it's a
database, right?
But why would it be any different than the way Aperture handles it? Like, why are you assuming that it wouldn't handle?
I don't know. Did Aperture handle them that well? I don't know. Some people say it did.
I didn't have 140,000. I don't even.
I'm going to download Aperture just to stick my entire library into it and see what happens.
All right.
I don't know. It's just that kind of weird. Hey, one last thing. I found this. Yes, I saw this. Did you see these pictures?
It's really strange.
They're so weird. So
very, it doesn't, it looks like a reenactor, yeah, but it's not.
There, these are pictures from the 1930s of Adolf Hitler basically testing poses that he's going to use in his speeches. And it's like, a dozen pictures or so.
Like, yeah, rehearsing these like dramatic sort of.
Yeah. What's interesting about them today, could you imagine a politician getting up and being this sort of dramatic from afar? Like, these are the kinds of gestures that people made on stage in a big theater where they had
you had to project, right?
Because there's guys who were, 200 rows back who need to know what you're doing. They didn't have
the big screens, on the side of the stage.
So everything's exaggerated. And it's just, it's fascinating that it really is theater.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the fact that he had a photographer shoot him doing this so that, it's Heinrich Hoffmann was Hitler's personal photographer.
Like, is he then going back and studying these? I wonder what his process was.
Hitler's personal photographer who took an astonishing 2 million pictures of the Führer.
Wow.
Here we see a series of photographs by Hoffmann of Hitler practicing his exaggerating hand gestures to be used in future speeches. Hitler actually characterized different effects for different poses, such as, I'm not even going to try the German, I will, Gebärdensprache, which is domineering, or Kampfrisch, which is pugnacious. It's so
campy? What? Campy?
Yeah. After he saw the negatives, Hitler ordered the photos to be destroyed. Hoffmann hid them away. After the seizure of his archives, they were released to the public. I don't know. Wow. I just thought this was weird. And you know what? This says
2 million pictures of Der Führer
on film.
Wow.
Cherevkov, the photographer I saw yesterday, he just threw out almost all of his slides and 4x5s, almost all of his transparencies, like 98% of them, he threw them out a couple weeks ago.
Threw them out?
Yep. Big giant bags. Shredded them. He shredded them.
Wow.
He paid hundreds of dollars to have a guy come and shred all of his work from the last 40 years.
See, those would be kind of interesting prints, like printing the shredded negatives, that would be interesting.
Yeah. It's just because he was just like, I didn't shoot personalities. He shot like still lifes for cosmetics companies and whatever else. Yeah. He's just like, no one wants the archives of some product that, Like, no one's ever going to ask for those.
Yeah. Some weird perfume bottle from the 80s.
Yeah. Like, it's just interesting, but it's also interesting from the point of view of Hitler here. He was obviously a very expressive guy.
Oh, sure.
And a lot of the game with, especially if you're trying to get portraits like this, is finding people who can emote, and don't feel weird about emoting, which is why models are models. It's A, they look good, but they also know how to sit and turn their hips the right way and all that to make the pictures look good too. It's about
some
that
of them. Although I don't like that one where like the elbows are out, but they're forward, and they're like crushing them together. That's
I do that all the time.
Do you?
I'm doing it right now. Actually, you just can't.
Are you?
Can you hear it in my voice?
See, it went up a little bit.
Yeah,
it went up a little.
I'm doing like it right now.
Oh, okay.
How do people do with crush?
The awkwardness means it's working. crush.
Did they crush it?
They really did. Yeah. May have been the best one yet.
From the participation or from
both from a participation standpoint and from just a really fantastic work. I mean, really, 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 really good work. Really, really, really good work.
Yeah.
And this is I love this. This is probably my favorite of them. And color, black and white, doesn't matter. Tyler, yeah. that race car shot where you're panning. Amazing. Really great.
Millie put up great stuff.
David put up some great stuff. Nicholas put up great. I mean, probably, assignment for assignment, both quality and quantity, this has been my favorite one.
You know what's kind of interesting about it is that in some of them, if I were driving, I would have even pushed it even further. Like some of them, there's blacks, but they could even go on even further.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, a couple of people went with silhouettes, which I think is different.
And doesn't it count?
I don't know that it doesn't count, but I think that's a different... I think that's a different assignment, and I'd like to, maybe we'll do silhouettes after, you know, a couple weeks from now, but
okay.
Yeah. Also, Michael Hendrickson posting some selfies in the OTP t-shirt in Paris.
So did Jason Fuchera.
So did Jason. Well, that was a great shot, Jason.
Jason looks so scary there.
I know. He's like, why so serious?
Why so serious?
He put up a great shot of these flowers. Looks almost like an x-ray. Did you see that? Looks great.
Yeah.
So yeah, really, really, really good work. I like this one.
You know what's interesting? This is slightly different than some of the other ones in the sense that we gave them a technique more than a subject matter.
Yeah.
So maybe that is telling us something.
Oh, also Frank, oh my God, I'm going to, Gillormini? Is it a hard G or a soft G? Gillormini? I'm sorry, Frank. Either way, really, really fun stuff that he's putting up. Like, it's blurred and there's some motion.
Yeah. Those are great.
Really great stuff. Apologies for your name, Frank, or my pronunciation of it. Not for your name. I'm sure it's a great name. I'm sorry the way I pronounced it.
I would say Gillormini.
Okay. Rinaldo, cool one of like the little boat.
Oh, yeah, with the rocks. Those rocks almost looks like it's a miniature set.
Yeah, it does. Like a little diorama.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Jennifer, good stuff.
So what's next week?
David Gardner, good stuff. Aruba. Yeah. Sorry you're in such a horrible place, David. Yeah. Yes. Sunrise in Aruba.
Must be tough. Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to do sunrise in Rancho Cucamonga, just as my, my own version of that.
Well, you can't do sunset. You go to sleep before that.
Well, yeah, it's true. Either that or I'm right in the middle of dessert.
What's the assignment for this week?
This week, I want to see playtime. So game time.
Okay. So this, game time. You could go sports. You could go checkers.
Yeah, it could
be sport.
It could, yeah, game time. Could be video games, could be sports, could be physical games, could be just you playing with your kids or you know, Alan, don't play with somebody else's
or
kids.
Adult time in the bedroom.
No.
Oh,
why do you always
got
to go there?
I didn't go there. I didn't go anywhere.
Honestly. So Bill's going to post pictures of his fur-lined handcuffs or something.
Mm.
Oh, no, there it is.
I'll have to buy some.
You're doing it again, aren't you, with the elbow?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so game time. Game time is this week.
Okay.
And then maybe we'll do silhouette next week. But yeah. All right, hit me with the photographer of the week. What do you got?
Okay, so somebody sent this in. I should have made a note of who sent it in. The last week we discussed paparazzi.
Right.
Are you going to start singing the song now?
What's the song?
That would be the Lady Gaga paparazzi song.
Okay. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm very proud of this.
Yeah.
I don't know that Lady Gaga song. In fact, I don't know any.
There's the great cover by the little 10-year-old kid singing it at a school talent show, though. It's much better than her version. And he's, you know, kid's got balls. Anyway, it is Ron Galella.
Okay.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I think so.
Okay. We were wondering whether paparazzi is photography. Is that sort of what we kind of came along with last year?
Last week, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the thing. I wouldn't put this guy.
Well,
that's the
thing. Why is it better?
I think it looks more intentional. It doesn't look as random. It doesn't look it doesn't look like he was just walking alongside holding the camera out willy-nilly. It looks like these were framed.
Okay.
I don't know.
Are just pictures of, you know, Mick Jagger standing outside a club, you know? Or is it time? And that's
maybe
the difference.
It is. I mean, look at this shot of Elvis.
Yeah.
You know? Just he's waving to the guy. Hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
You know, I guess I don't know.
I don't know about taking pictures of random people on the street, like being a street photographer, you know, being, what's his name? Who's the bald guy we like? Whose name I can never remember.
Come on.
Oh, come on. It's right there.
Come on. Nope. I'm going to let you go. Come on.
It's going to take forever. I'm not going to wait.
come on.
But
it's right there.
Is it different? Is that different than being on the street and trying to take pictures of Jackie O or whoever?
Well, I think part of this is
he apparently followed Jackie O around for years, and he was eventually ordered to stay 50 yards away from her.
Right. Right.
It's like, okay, that's just being a jerk, isn't it?
I think so. But some of these, I mean, look at this one of Steve McQueen on the set of Papillon.
Yes, where he's got the coffee, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that could easily be a portrait today.
Sure.
There's one, it's kind of a bust shot of Warhol.
Yep.
Where he's obviously stopped and said, okay, do your thing.
Yeah. So is there a...
It feels like there's an aesthetic difference.
Is this one
difference?
Of those subset things where it's like, you know, a square is a rectangle, but not rectangles aren't necessarily squares?
Maybe.
Where it's like, you know, yes, random street photographs of celebrities, however you want to define that, are paparazzi, and some paparazzi are portraits, but not every paparazzi picture. You know what I mean?
These don't feel as, and I'm going to get in trouble with this, they don't feel as invasive as some of the paparazzi photos that I've seen recently.
Well, obviously some of these people were okay with getting their picture taken here.
Yes.
But these pictures of Jackie O cross, on the right column.
Where are you at?
Right column. I'm on his photo gallery on his photo gallery. Site. Three up from the bottom on the right. Jackie O crossing the street.
Okay.
Why does this matter?
I don't think that
Who
matters.
Gives a
but
crap?
If you look at his body of work, I do agree that there is kind of an unnatural fascination with her, that she seemed to be a target in a different way than anyone else he photographed.
It was a little bit before my era that people were really fascinated with her. It was like the 60s, 70s, right? It's...
You know, you've got this shot of Chris Stein, Debbie Harry, and Andy Warhol. That's not a paparazzi shot. They're all there arm in arm.
Right. Yeah, they were at a club, and this guy was taking pictures. And I have friends who go to clubs now and just take random pictures of people falling all over each other like that, right? That's different. I don't know. It's interesting.
I find this work interesting. I really do.
Okay. But you can't really define why.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. Some of these I find interesting. Some of these I think are just stupid people walking out on the street. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But some of them, I find that there is an exchange. There is a participation between photographer and subject. That shot of McQueen, he's not, you know, he doesn't have his hand up. He's not chasing him off the set. You know, there is an exchange there. There is an acceptance that you are there and making pictures.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't describe it.
I don't know either. So I know the question is this really most of this stuff? I wouldn't necessarily say is paparazzi in the same sense that we today where it's like, look, this girl sitting having lunch with her friend or whatever. It's like, you know, that kind of crap.
Right.
I don't know.
But to your point, is it different in that the times were different? Was
maybe there were less of
these looked at differently,
and there were less of these guys, and there weren't websites that needed fodder every 16 seconds.
Right. He wasn't standing in a crowd of 50 other photographers making this same photo.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe he was, I don't know.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think. Podcast at ontakingpictures.com or I'm at Bill Wadman. You're at Jeffrey Sidoris on Twitter, Faded and Blurred, BillWadman.com/blog. If you want to read some blog stuff, I put up a couple, posts, one about how I made the little corner set.
Right.
And one about how I made that picture for Creative Mornings that some people have found interesting. But if you haven't seen those links, go check them out. Hey, one last thing. Have you heard about this whole Synology thing? Okay,
Synology.
Synology, the NAS devices?
No.
Okay. You know what I'm talking about, though?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Network attacks, yeah. Attached storage, yeah.
So a lot of these Synology boxes have apps, so you could access the data from, you know, when you're away from your computer and that kind of stuff. So they're sort of open through your firewall to the world and that kind of stuff. Well, there's malware that has gotten on a bunch of these that has done that whole CryptoLocker thing where it encrypts all of your data.
Oh, until you pay them?
Friend of mine got bit this weekend.
Oh.
A last year of his photos.
Oh, no.
They want 0.6 of a Bitcoin, which is like $300-something to unlock it.
Because they're networked. See? They had it right in Galactica, man. Don't network the computers.
And it's like, it's all of my, yeah, I mean, I have stuff up on Dropbox and whatever it is with strong passwords and, you know, but my other drives are, I plug it in and I unplug it.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like it's scary. So anyway, if you guys have a Synology NAS device that you're using, there's an article on, it was on Slashdot. I'll throw it in the thing. That's scary.
Yeah.
Because
hey, can we just say that, you know, holding people's data hostage that's kind of,
oh, it's a,
you know, sorry.
It's a,
can you bleep that? Sorry.
Yeah, it is a move. It's true.
Yeah. that's no bueno.
No, it's terrible. So anyway, I'll put a link in the show notes.
Go back to Ron's gallery page.
Yes, on it.
Third row, all the way on the right. Can we just talk about that that outfit that E is wearing?
Elvis?
Come on now. Look at that thing.
Yeah. Somebody was telling me recently that Elvis had real serious problems with his digestive system and that he would... This is going to be way too oversharing. Apparently, he had serious constipation issues and that his weight would fluctuate 10 to 15 pounds because of that.
Maybe it was all the peanut butter and Nana sandwiches.
It was that plus, you know, whatever opiates he was doing.
Come on. That was the last 2 years of his life. Don't jump in there. He was upset because his mother died. It was never the same.
Yeah. But I'm just saying that's the part where it got bad. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Anything else?
All
right. So we need questions for next week.
Yeah. Questions for next week.
Send us questions or leave a voicemail 347-687-9411. And we will bang out another spectacular Q&A show next week.
Spectacular, spectacular.
Dun, 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 dun,
the word, the vernacular.
Where's that from?
Moulin Rouge.
Oh, I never saw it.
Oh my God. What am I? I don't, you know, sometimes I just
don't know who you
are
anymore.
I don't know what to do with you.
Yeah. Hey, my friend Ali had never seen Ghostbusters before watching it recently.
What? Hey, okay, real quick, quick.
Yep.
The OTP final thought. How are you going to do Ghostbusters 3
with women
when Bill Murray wants nothing to do with it and Ramis is dead?
It's a waste of time. It's trying to bring, like, just make a new idea. Come up with a new idea.
Yeah. Oh, and apparently Sylvester Stallone is writing the Expendables, which is an all female Expendables cast.
I have not seen any of the Expendables. Are they worth watching or no? Okay, I'll take that as an answer.
He's trying to get Sigourney Weaver on board.
Are they really that bad, or are they just like fun?
You know,
silly
what?
Stuff.
Okay, if you dug action movies of the 80s,
yeah,
then you will love them because they're all of your favorite action stars from the 80s back in a new film.
Okay. All right. Well, then I will go watch them.
I mean, Harrison Ford is in the latest one, for God's sake.
Yeah. How did they get him?
Cha-ching.
Yeah. I don't think Harrison Ford needs the money. He's, I think he made all the money in Raiders of the Lost or Indiana Jones 4.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, whatever.
Yeah, they all right. Should have put more money into production.
We'll talk to you next week.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way. Say what you wanna say.